Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find Inforum online at inforumsf.org. I'm Kishore Hari, Director of the Bay Area Science Festival. Tonight's event is Freakonomics with Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, How to Think Like a Freak. Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner first went rogue with their nonfiction book, Freakonomics, in 2005, and they've been bringing economics to the people ever since. Since 2005, Levitt, a University of Chicago economist, and Dubner, a New York Times journalist, have blazed a Freakonomics path with the popular blog, a documentary, and one of the most listened to podcasts in the world. Just on one stop on the way to world domination. Tonight, we are here to learn more about How to Think Like a Freak, their latest book to expose the hidden side of just about everything. So please welcome to the stage Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you. Oh, are those wings already? M&Ms?
Uh-huh. It's a surprise for later.
All right. So
I have to say off the bat, I'm one of those Freakonomics junkies, and I have tried and failed miserably trying to apply the lessons from the book to my life.
Okay.
First of all, with my baby's name.
Right.
So I tried to give him a name that was going to lead to global success. So can you refresh our audience's memory about that?
If you want a name that leads to global success, I suggest Stephen seems to work pretty well. No, what do you got? What'd you name the kid?
I named him Ira because he's a 3-year-old with the soul of an 80-year-old Jewish man.
Okay, good.
Wait, let me stop you for a second because one of the interesting things is we wrote this whole bit about names, and I've had 100 people come up to me.
Could I just say, you don't look dignified with popcorn in your hand.
I'm not trying to be dignified. I'm not trying to be dignified.
So well, if she doesn't look dignified now, let's see about now.
Oh, thank you. I've had hundreds of people come up to me and say, that was so cool how you showed that the name you give to your child matters for your life. And I never know what to do. About half the time I say, no, actually we showed the opposite. And the other half the time I say, thank you. I'm really glad you enjoyed that. I'm glad it helped you. Either way, they're happier when I just say thank you. So I've, more and more now, I just say thank you. But actually, what we did show is that it absolutely did not matter what name you gave to your child. And
so Ira will be fine.
Yeah.
That's all I need to hear.
Although my kid's name is Solomon. So burdening children with names of old Jewish men is what we have in common.
But I'm curious about this. This new book, did you write it essentially for schlubs like me that can't actually listen to what you write and actually teach me how to think properly? What's the genesis of this Think Like a Freak movement?
So the first book, well, maybe we should start at the beginning. Do you want to hear the whole origin myth?
I want to hear your superhero origin story.
So we can do it fairly quickly because we want to, get up to date. But so I'll tell you very quickly. So this book began in 2003 is when we met, and I was assigned by the New York Times Magazine, where I wrote and edited, to go do a profile of this economist who just won a big award. And the economist's name was Stephen Levitt at the University of Chicago. And I was working on a book about the psychology of money. So I'd been talking to a lot of economists. So my editor thought all economists are roughly the same. So this guy won an award, go interview him. And let me just say a few things about the difference between us. So obviously, he's the economist, I'm a journalist, he lives in Chicago, I live in New York. He's a genius, and I'm slightly above average intelligence. But I'm also smart enough to know that if you want to write books about economics and have people buy them, you should find a genius with whom to collaborate. So that was my one smart move. But even even that, I didn't really do on purpose because I turned down this assignment a few times. And the reason was, you never want to write about someone who's just won the big award for two reasons. One is they tend to get all awardy on you in their behavior. And also, it's usually for
work. I want to know what that means. What does awardy mean?
You'll find out when he starts to talk. And but also, usually the awards go for work that you've done a while ago, you know, not what you're going, what's going on now. And that's, as a writer, you want to be where what's going on now. Anyway, I was finally going to be in Chicago for something else, and I decided to download and read all of Levitt's papers, and they were just, you know, astonishingly interesting and different from one another, and so different from all the economics that I'd been reading about and studying. They were about cheating sumo wrestlers and whether your child's name has any influence on the outcome of their life and things like this. And so I was thrilled to be writing about him, and the piece was, I was having a good time. You know, a magazine piece takes a couple, 3 months to put together. And I thought, you know, even though this took me off from my book for a little while, I'm glad I did it, even if nobody reads it. And I assume that nobody would read it, because it's coming out in August, which is beach weather, and I didn't figure that people would take to the beach this 8-page magazine article about a research economist from Chicago. It's not what they want to read about. So I thought that this article would be, like most articles and books are, you know, a dud. There are a lot of writers writing, and much of it never gets read. And the period right before something comes out is what writers call the lull before the lull. It's very it's very quiet, and then it comes out, and it's still very quiet. Then your mother calls you, and she says, "Steve, weren't you putting out a book this year?" And like, "Yeah, Mom, that was out 3 months ago." And so I was prepared for this article to be a dud, just like all the others. And my fear was confirmed when the morning the article was published in the New York Times Magazine, my phone rang, and it was the only call I got that morning, and it was Levitt's mom back in Minneapolis, and she said, "I just wanted to thank you for treating my boy fair in the New York Times." And I thought, oh my God, that was the biggest waste of 3 months' time ever. So that's how it began. Fortunately, I was wrong.
Is this your recollection, too, of being treated fairly?
Oh, I mean, Stephen hates it when I say this, but so he interviewed me, and so he said he'd stay for 2 hours, and he stayed for 36 hours of interviews over 3 days. It was excruciating. And the thing is, when someone comes from the New York Times to interview you, what are you going to do, send them away? As soon as you send them away, they'll be bitter. They'll write something horrible about you. So I chuffed it out to the bitter end. I mean, it got so bad that finally I couldn't take it anymore. And the last 3 or 4 hours we spent with me getting very drunk at an off-track betting parlor in Chicago.
For an experiment, of course, right?
For
the pick,
you know,
six.
Surviving, yeah. Basically. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the point at which as the alcohol took hold, he asked me what my view of the CIA was, and I said that given the right data, I would be so much better than the CIA at catching the terrorists. And as soon as I said it, I thought, oh my God, why did I say that? That was so stupid. And I thought, he's got 36 hours of transcripts. What's the likelihood that that one sentence will end up in the piece? And the last sentence of the last paragraph was me throwing down the gauntlet to the CIA. But it turned out well, because a week later the CIA called me and they invited me down, and we've told part of the story in Super Freak, but we tell the really good part of the story in this book. But so I hated Dubner by the time he left. I mean, I could not have been happy to see him go. But the thing he did, which I give him tremendous credit for, is he created this persona.
You didn't hate me. I just want to clarify. Hate is a strong... Did you really hate me?
This is why you're sitting
far apart. I never wanted to see him again. Let me just put it that way.
There are a lot of people I never want to see again that I don't hate.
That could be. That's right.
Larry Hagman, I had a thing with. I never want to see Larry Hagman again, JR. But I don't hate him. We had a problem, but... No, Larry.
So Dubner created this almost completely fictitious persona of me. So if you read the old PC Rope in the New York Times, it's like I'm this super genius and people feed me problems and I scratch my head and I type at the computer and the answers just come spewing out of me like within a half an hour. And it could not be farther from the truth. But I tell you, to have that kind of persona and reputation, I have milked that for the last 10 years. I don't plan to stop anytime soon. And it worked on the so the publishers got totally sucked in by Dubner's portrayal of me, and like, will you write a book? And I said to the three or four who called me in the days after he wrote that piece, I said, just go to my webpage and read any of my academic studies, and I'm sure you will rescind your offer to have me write a popular book because I can't write at all. But then somebody came up with the idea that we should write a book together, and. You didn't want to write with me. I wanted to write with you probably even less. But we got on the phone. And look, he's a journalist, I'm an economist. And one thing that we share is that in the end, it's all about money, right? It's like, you did not know. It's like, it depends on how much you pay me. I mean, it's all about transactions. And so, interesting, we both agreed on how much money we would need to write a book. And it was kind of, we both kind of said, yeah, for a boatload of money, I'd be willing to write a book with you. And so we told his literary agent, if she could get us a boatload of money, we'd do it. And then she got it. And we're like, oh my God, now we really have to write this book. What are we going to do? And the strange thing was, as soon as we started working together, we got along great. And, I'll tell you the thing that really was the hint that we were getting along great is we had agreed to do this, but we had never talked about how to split the profit. And so Dubner called me. And I don't remember the exact details, but he said something like, I think a fair share of the book would be 60-40 to split the profits. Okay? And I said, I was actually thinking 2/3, 1/3. And he said, okay, well, I guess we won't be able to write the book then because I'm not willing to do it for 1/3. I said, no, I thought you should get 2/3 and I should get 1/3. And he said, I thought you should get 60 and I should get 40. So we settled on 50, and that's the last, the last fight we ever had.
It seems like you've blossomed into a really great friendship. Take us into, how it actually is between you two, because you don't live in the same city. You don't see each other that often.
I think that's the key, yeah. we've spent more time together in the last week than we probably did in the previous year. Yeah, but we do.
So how do all of these amazing ideas get translated then when you're so far apart?
So I would say that every story on every page of whatever the three books, comes about in one of maybe 10 different ways. So sometimes Levitt's done research where there's an academic paper that I then ask him to help me really understand it all the way through and then try to figure out the story to write that. Then I'll interview some other people to supplement it. But honestly, I don't have a good answer for that question. There's so many, every story, they come from just being observant, knowing people smarter than us or at least smarter than me, the radio. So I would be, if you guys don't mind, I have a question I want to ask you guys. So when we started the podcast, so how many of you listened to the podcast? Shout out or... So maybe like 60-70%. So what's interesting...
Let's just cut a deal and say 50-50.
Cool. <Yeah. laughs> So when we started it, Levitt was just humoring me because I really wanted an NPR show. I just thought it'd be really fun to have a show like, those guys have and talk about your stuff and that voice. And but I knew, I'd been in enough meetings by now with Freakonomics stuff to know that if you come to an institution like NPR or public radio with an idea like that, you'll just be in meetings for 3 years, and then you'll end up with a show that's like a cooking show, a macrobiotic so nothing like what I would want to do. And so we just decided that we would pilot, just make a podcast that would act as a pilot for the radio show. And Levitt, you had no interest in doing that, and we're pretty sure it was going to be a miserable failure. But he's a good, he likes to
Why did you decide to do the podcast then?
Oh, I mean, I said to Steve, if you want to do all the work, that's fine. You can do a podcast. I'm happy to watch you do it.
He's a, He's my favorite guest, but we don't make him work very hard. So when we started it, it wasn't meant to grow into, you know, this big thing. But now, so as a writer, you always use your writing, whatever it is, to kind of develop ideas for the book you're working on. That's just the way it's always been in the history of writing, at least among writers who are journalists. But this time around, we've had a weird collision in that some people feel they know us and the material so well from the podcast that they feel the book is like not the big Shazam wow that they were expecting from a brand new book. So I'm curious, of those of you who have read the book already or read parts of it, raise your hand if you're dissatisfied.
Luckily, there's just lights.
All right,
in our
eyes,
so
you know, we just proved one of our theories, which is that public shaming works really well,
and that
no one in their right mind would raise their hand. I'm glad I didn't ask the other question.
So, Do your other question.
How many of you are okay with it? What's the other question?
The other question you like to ask audiences.
The other question I like to ask audiences: washing their hands in public toilet.
Let's not ask that question. But so what it was the genesis of this book? I'm going to move quickly from toilet.
Oh, sorry. That's where we started. Sorry. I apologize. So this book, so first book was accidental and quasi-reluctant. First book was much more successful than either of us could have ever imagined. We were very grateful for that. And we thought we should pack it in then. It'd be like, great, once and done. And then, but we really, I think by then, we really enjoyed working together. And Leva had a lot of really interesting research going on. So we thought, you know, we'll take another 4 or 5 years, do a second book, which we did. We liked that one. And then we thought maybe we should pack it in. And we definitely didn't want to do a third book that was very much like the first two. And for like a week, we had this other idea that seemed brilliant. And then after like 7 or 8 days, it didn't seem so brilliant. And then we thought that, you know, people write to us all the time. I'm sure many of you, raise your hand if you've written to us in the past.
I think a lot of people here have.
All right, that's not so many,
not
maybe 30 or 40.
You,
okay. All right. I hope we answered, or at least fainted toward answer. We didn't answer you. Okay, great. That's why you're sitting in the front row with rocks. So we do read all the email. We try to answer what we can. But the thing that's astonishing about it is, it's incredibly exhilarating and very frustrating to get all these people asking these incredibly interesting and heartfelt questions about how to solve problems. That's what it really is. People want to know how to fix stuff, whether it's something within their family, their community, their own job, politics, or whatnot. And, you know, we would kind of make these attempts to do it, but if you're getting 50 emails with hard problems a day, you're totally lost. So we thought, rather than trying and failing probably to answer a small number of this big number of questions, what if we could instead write a book that would deputize the world or whoever in the world wants to think like this? Because it's really not so hard, most of it at least. So that's really the genesis for the
book. Do you really feel like this is something that can be trained? It's so simple that anyone can learn how to think like this.
Except for parts, but yeah.
Yeah, no, most of it. I mean, here's how I think of the book. In some sense, it's got a bunch of stories in it. But we thought really hard about what our approach was. And I think we even surprised ourselves. I mean, I'd be honest, I thought that our approach was much deeper than it was. I thought that when we looked inside ourselves, we would come up with these brilliant insights that no one had ever said before. But I think what really happened instead was we realized how much common sense goes into what we do. And, you know, if any of you were asked to, say, write down the 10, you know, in navigating the world, what are the 10 most important things to do? We'd all have a different list. And probably every one of our lists would overlap, and there'd be, you know, it would seem kind of obvious to anyone exposed. But I think in the end, you know, what we do is really simple. You know, we start by saying, in order to really have a chance of learning, you have to say, I don't know. Be willing to say, I don't know. And I've spent a lot of time in the last 10 years around people in business and other settings who absolutely and categorically pretend to know the truth when they have no idea what they're talking about. And you simply get locked in if you can't do that. But you know, that's one of 10 things. But it's totally obvious. But it wouldn't have been on most of your lists. And so, in that sense, I think there's some value to being reminded of it.
But is that part of economics training to say I don't know? It doesn't seem to jive with what I see on TV. Paul Krugman's not out there saying, shrugging his shoulders, I don't know.
That is true. It is absolutely a part of science and academics, and economists aren't scientists, and but they are academic, to, you know, so an academic project might take you a year. And who's going to start on a project and spend a year if they know the answer already? But but in general, I think that is a, it's an unusual, especially now in the era of people like Paul Krugman, who get up on TV talking heads, who always act as if they know the answers. Mm-hmm. I think people forget that, you know, those guys don't know the answers. I mean, the macroeconomy, no one understands the macroeconomy. It's a big, complicated mess. And it's, and but you can't get on TV if you don't pretend. And actually, I think people, when we get interviewed on various TV shows, they're always surprised that we're willing to say we don't know, because they're not used to, because every public figure, every politician now insists on looking competent. And looking competent means always knowing the answer, or somehow answering a different question so no one knows you didn't know the answer.
But you face a lot of criticism as well for saying, I don't know, and getting up and sort of not following the path that people expect you to. How does that criticism and sort of inform the work, if at all, or how do you respond to it?
One does for saying one doesn't know in a situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we dealt with this a little bit in this book and in the podcast. We just put out a podcast on this topic, and it was really interesting when we did the podcast on I don't know. You know, it's the media works so well in some ways, but it's so it's not yet where it needs to be yet. Because right now we have the ability for everybody to contribute to everything, but it's kind of works in the wrong order. What I mean by that is, when we put out like a book or a podcast episode, we then hear all these amazing stories that would have been fantastic in the book or the podcast, right? So within days of putting out this podcast and having the book release, talking about the value of saying I don't know, how hard it can be, how the incentives kind of conspire against it, we got all these good and really inspiring examples of places that do it well or try to teach people to do it well. The military is one where a lot of people cite where, you know, there are basically five answers you give if you're put on the spot. Yes, sir, no, sir, da-da-da, and I'll find out, sir. And there's basically, according to everybody in the military who's told me this, my brother was an Air Force pilot long ago, the premium is on knowledge and information. And maybe it's because they're in an institution where they're already getting beat up all the time, okay? And so your reputation is only as good as what you can do, as opposed to many of the rest of us, where our reputations are kind of inflated based on what we seem to know. There, it's a reputation based on what you actually know and can do. Because there's a big difference between me sitting in a room typing words and my brother flying a plane. And so you kind of really need to know. So I love the idea that we're in a period where some cultures, some institutions are building a culture where it's more encouraged to do it. That said, I think it's still very hard to do. The incentives conspire against it.
Let's talk about incentives, which is a big portion of your work. Why incentives work and why they're so important for us to take advantage of in the right ways.
Yeah, so, I mean, we define incentives so broadly. Not just financial incentives, but also what we call social incentives, which is the approval and warmth of friends and colleagues, and then also I think we think of morality, the moral incentive. So the kind of the what's internalized of the guilt you feel can also be a very powerful force. So in defining incentives that broadly, it's almost redundant to say that incentives are really important. But every economist starts in thinking about every problem by thinking about the incentives of the various actors that are involved. And it's important, I think, that you think not just about financial incentives, but social and moral incentives. The social incentives, I think, are often the strongest, that basically peer pressure is overwhelming on humans and we know from 50 years of psychological studies, you can get people to say and do anything if you have enough peer pressure. And so it's kind of, to economists, it's kind of like, well, where else could you start? I mean, how else would you ever start thinking about a problem? Although we know from politics that many people don't start there. That, in fact, many people really start from a very moral place, which is what's right and wrong. What, you know, what does my religion say?
But you say right off the bat, put away your moral compass. Like,
yeah, so our view, and this I think not everyone agrees with, but our view is that it makes sense to put aside morality at the beginning. So you're interested in the answer to a problem. And our view is to figure out an answer to a problem, it's better to just to understand the causal relationship, the link between, to understand the data, and not to care, not to worry about where the data will take you, but simply to understand the answer. So I think a perfect example would be legalized abortion and crime. So many years ago with John Donahue, I had a theory, and the theory was that unwanted children are at risk for crime and other hardships. Legalized abortion in the United States led to fewer unwanted children, and so legalized abortion, because of fewer unwanted children, would lead to less crime. Okay, and that has nothing to do with morality. That is just a statement of what we thought might be fact based on the data, and then we looked at the data, we found it to be true. Now, if we had, like almost everyone else in the world, thought about abortion from a moral perspective, either you know it's murder or it's a woman's right, you just it kind of confuses you and it confounds you. It makes it hard to actually think about what's going on. And so I think by putting it's a great example where by putting aside the morality, you start to understand the world. So all we're trying to do is describe the world. We know crime went down. Did it happen because of this? We think so. The data seems to support it. Now that doesn't say anything about what the right thing, right? So then you have to go back and bring the morality back into it, which is okay, even if I know that's true, do I care? Does it inform any of my decisions? And the answer we wrote in Freakonomics is no. No single person on the planet should change their stance on abortion because of what we found between abortion and crime. But that doesn't make it an unimportant result because, for instance, you know, a lot of people were saying we should be locking up more people in prison because the reason crime went down was because of prisons. But by actually knowing that maybe it wasn't that, it was legalized abortion, it helps inform choices, but not the choices you would have expected.
Let's just say that wasn't the most popular conclusion you guys have ever come to. And you faced a lot of backlash from it. Mm-hmm. And I have to say the biggest backlash that I heard about, I was talking to my mom about you guys the other night. She says hello. I was trying to relate a story from Freakonomics, so she got like the weight of it. And I used the abortion story, and her immediate response is like, well, that's just, you know, coincidence. Mm-hmm. She was essentially saying how would you ever come gather enough data to actually show that that relationship is true?
I like that question. I like that question more than the response of, I hate that answer, and therefore no, this is what you get a lot, not just us, but anybody. I hate the idea of that answer, and therefore I'm not going to think about how the answer was arrived at. So actually, I would argue that that's a two steps down the road toward at least thinking about it in the right way.
But she essentially said, I don't believe you guys.
Right.
And so how do you respond to those people that don't believe your conclusions oftentimes?
Right. I mean, we wrote a chapter in a book. I mean, we explained it. I mean, Levitt could talk for 4 hours about the proof that went into the paper, which, you know, my first job is being first the journalist writing about him and then the collaborator writing with him was to, you know, see if that argument feels, smells, and adds up right. And, you know, to me it was, and to many, many other people, it was very compelling. But it is this kind of what Levitt calls a collage of evidence that you're right. To say that it's a correlation and therefore it's causal, even though it's, and even though there's some logic to it, is not a proof at all. But I would argue that the proof that we assembled in the chapter is compelling and convincing to many people. But you know what? It's our point. Our point is not to win every argument or make every point. And in fact, I don't know about Levitt, I'd let you answer. I don't really care so much if people agree or even like the stories. To me, the point of telling a story is to do your best to convey a set of facts and circumstances in a truthful way that gives a sense of magnitude, that gives a sense of time, that includes statistics and so on, in a way that anybody can read it or listen to it and be a little bit more down the road toward thinking about things well. Because I am a firm believer in the humanistic tradition that the more people that think about things well, theoretically, the better the outcome is for everybody. So, we often get asked about, you know, if I don't buy your argument on this, can I buy your... I think that's, you know, just totally beside the point.
Do you not care as well if they don't agree with the conclusion that you're reaching?
I kind of live in my own world. I don't care very much about what other people think of me in general very much. So
how do you have that superpower where you don't care about what people think of you?
I think that is
honestly,
I think that is a superpower.
It's called autism. but no, I didn't mean that in a bad way. I meant that in a serious way. I wasn't trying to you know, be insensitive. I mean, I think it is, I think somehow I you know, partly it was the way I was raised. I mean, I was raised in a very unusual family. My mom was a psychic, and my father was the
Your mom was a psychic?
Yeah. So my mom was a book channeler, if you know what that means. So she goes into
trance.
Yeah,
they know what that means.
And books come, because we're in San Francisco.
A book channeler? Who's ever heard of a book channeler?
Oh, I thought maybe in San Francisco everything knew what it meant. So a book channeler is someone who goes into a trance and a higher being goes through her fingers and writes the book. So that was my mom. Mm-hmm. And my dad was the world's medical expert on intestinal gas, truthfully. And so so I was kind of caught in the middle of these two worlds. But
and economics was in the middle somehow.
Right, yeah.
But so I don't know. I mean, yeah, no, I'm just, I mean, Dubner will say I'm not that sensitive to what other people think. But I tell you, I think a lot of, let me be like a little bit serious about academics now. There's a strange way of rhetoric in academics in which in a seminar or a paper, an economist has come up with a hypothesis, and then the whole goal is to prove the hypothesis. Now, never mind that we don't follow the scientific method at all. So what we do is we have a hypothesis, and then we go to the data, and if the data prove the hypothesis wrong, then we find a hypothesis that fits the data, and we pretend like that was the one we started with in the first place. I mean, every economist does it, and it's really strange, and we all know we do it. And I actually do something completely different in my papers, and I try to get my students to do it, but I'm like practically the only one in. And it fits with what you're saying, is what I always try to do is I just try to show people the data. And then, because the thing is, everyone can agree on the data, that I don't do anything to the data that any other economist that looked at the same data wouldn't show you the same thing. And then I just show you, so that's all we know. And in essence, all you really, really know are what you see in the data. Okay. And then you take a deep breath and you say, so how do I interpret the data? And here everyone will disagree. And my view is usually not to put forth one hypothesis, but to say, what is the entire universe of hypotheses I can possibly think of? Okay, and which of them square with the facts, and which of them don't? And it's a different way of doing business. And then what's great about it, so then if a reader writes in and says, wait, you didn't consider this hypothesis, it's not like it was a failure. You say, oh, excellent. Okay, now I have 101 hypotheses to consider, and I hope that it turns out that your one turns out to be better than the other 100, because then I know the answer. And it's a very, it's just a different way of looking at the world, and I think it really informs how we think about stuff.
Just a reminder to everyone to fill out their question cards with your name on it and get them to the front so we can get set up for Q&A later. I want to track back to thinking like a freak. Though, and really the brunt of what I took away was the notion of we need to be able to ask the right questions, going to that hypothesis statement that you're asking. And we sit sort of in a world with numerous big problems. Like we're here in San Francisco where there is, you know, ostensibly a housing crisis. Like it, rather than what's the solution, what's the right questions we need to be asking about situations like that? Mm-hmm.
So I'll give a ridiculous example that people who are motivated to apply to less ridiculous topics could maybe, you know, use as a guiding light. So yeah, I think when you talk about problem like income inequality, poverty generally, famine, we tend to nuclear energy. We tend to focus on the parts of the problem that disturb us and the very, very visible parts, which are often maybe not even the problem so much as the symptom. And then as everybody here has seen and as we've discussed at some length, ideology gets involved, and there are a lot of arguments of people on every side of the issue kind of shouting at each other, not really trying to persuade each other, but just trying to have their argument be known to prove how right they are, none of which is very productive, unfortunately. So, you know, you're right. If you ask a different question, so if you ask, you know, income inequality, let's assume, is a terrible thing if it gets out of sight, what should be done about it? Is that the right question? I don't know. It's a really hard one. One question that we ask, again, trivial and ridiculous, in the book, we tell a story of this hot dog eating champion named Takeru Kobayashi, who wanted to become the hot dog eating champion, even though he was this obscure, unknown, lightweight college kid in Japan. And so we describe at great length the process he went through. And he arrived at a set of solutions that were entirely different than everybody else that had come before him by essentially asking a different question. So basically, I don't know if have you guys seen the Coney Island Hot Dog Eating Championship on TV. You know, it's incredibly...
It's insane.
It's insane. It's
and
also,
like a million people watch this on ESPN.
A million on ESPN. It got up to about 2 million. It's peaked, unfortunately. If you ever see it live in Coney Island, it's even more disgusting because you have to imagine... It's the New York City heat and humidity in July, and they've pre-cooked these hundreds of dogs that are just sitting out steaming in the sun. And then these big lumbering guys get up there and just start, argh. And then if you stand really close, you see all the stuff that falls down on the ground. It's unbelievable. It's like bad feeding time at the zoo. So anyway, the previous record was 25 and one-eighth hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes, which is just an astonishing number. And Kobe, I won't go into the details here, unknown, as I said, unheralded, came in, and his very first time in a hot dog eating championship ate 50. So he doubled the world record, okay? Nobody doubles any world record ever, all right? This is the equivalent of Usain Bolt running the 100 meters in about 4.7 seconds, which is like somewhere between a taxi and a cheetah, okay? So that's not going to happen. But Kobe doubled the world record, and so we spent a lot of time talking with him about how he got there and what he did. So the story we tell in the book, I won't go into it now, but basically he did a lot of tactical and strategic and mental and physical things that were very different from everybody else. Why? Because here's what he said. He said, I came to the conclusion that everybody else was asking the wrong question. The question they were asking was, how can I eat a bunch of hot dogs faster? That seems like a sensible question, right?
Sensible is a weird word for this whole conversation.
True. Sensible in the context of the ridiculousness, okay? That seems an appropriate question. Kobe asked a different question. He said, how can I figure out how to eat one hot dog faster? And he engineered the process totally differently, which meant taking each dog and bun, breaking it in half to start, which nobody ever thought to do. This came to be known as the Solomon maneuver, after King Solomon in the Bible, who threatened to cut the baby in two. Then he would separate the dog and the bun because he found the dog he could chew very, very quickly. He could almost slurp it down like a dolphin eating heron at the zoo. And then the bun, which is actually really hard to eat on its own, he learned he could soak the bun in water, then squeeze out the excess water, then pop it in his mouth, kind of like a bun ball. And the added benefit of that was he didn't have to pause later for beverage, like all the other guys were pausing. So he basically re-engineered the entire thing by asking a different question. Not how can I starve myself and train at all-you-can-eat buffets, but how can I eat one hot dog faster? And by doing so, he came up with a different solution to the problem. If we could all redefine problems more willfully like that, use data to do so, I think we could do better at the big problems.
What are some interesting questions you guys are asking now that are a little bit different?
How long will this book tour last?
Speaking of, I know. So Levitt doesn't love the book tour. Let's just say.
He says. This is a point of contention.
How do you describe the book tour?
I have no idea. What did I say?
Luckily, we have a quote.
Torture.
You describe the book tour as that the dark side of me will come out on the book tour. Because talking to strangers isn't your thing.
True.
And so you open up to your audience.
My suicidal tendencies definitely emerge on book tours.
Usually in California, too.
Yeah, it was really bad the first tour.
But we have an incentive for you because you've made it through this long. Like, a reader wrote in with a few tips for something for you to do. And number four on that list was just have a pile of bacon around.
Oh, so there you go. And you know what? So when we were in New York, thank you. I'm going to have this bacon. When we were in New York.
By the way, Levitt eats terribly. KFC is his favorite food backstage. That's what we found out.
Yeah, I'm not a role model for a vegan lifestyle. But in New York, a guy felt so sorry for me that he handed me a $10 gift certificate to In-N-Out Burger, which I took advantage of today. Because he knew I was going out to California. He felt sorry for me.
So here's the thing. I know Steve Levitt pretty well. And And I thought I could tell when he's exaggerating or lying or telling the truth. And I have to say he fooled me on this one because he said on the podcast, oh, book tour, so hard. I have to go out all those adoring people and they adore me. It's so hard, right? And
the life of an academic.
The quote I remember is, you can't spell torture without tour. And but I think that he gamed me. He needed me to believe it so that I could help him play along, and that it was all purely strategic so that he could get the sympathy that he's been getting. And it's unbelievable. People are treating him like he's just back from the first man to walk on. Oh! So well done. Well
Thank
played,
you.
Sir.
Thank
yeah.
You.
Yeah.
But going back, what are some questions that you're asking right now in research that are sort of a little bit unusual, let's just say, these sort of freakish questions that you're approaching?
Yes, I would say my favorite question right now, and it came out of the podcast that we did on quitting, and which is now one of the chapters of the book, is about we think people just don't quit enough. And we had some theories about why we think people didn't quit enough. But
why do people don't quit enough? This runs contrary to like everything we ever like my when entire upbringing, basically.
Yeah, this is your thing. You do it. I don't want to take the credit for your thing.
Well, very
you're
going
to take credit for quitting.
No, very, very briefly. You know, we've all been brought up in a culture that we're all familiar with. That quitting is, you know, somewhere between moral and venial sin. You know that Winston Churchill, you know, told the schoolboys at Harrow, his school in October 41, you know, never, 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 never give up in anything large or petty and so on. And, you know, if you were the prime minister of a great nation facing extinction from Nazi Germany, it's a good idea not to give up, not to quit. For most of us, the stakes are not or ever will be as high. We're talking about a career choice or a relationship or a project or a startup, and we've been so encouraged or so discouraged from quitting. Vince Lombardi, winners never quit and quitters never win. It just doesn't make any sense. If you examine it even a little bit from the opportunity cost perspective, it doesn't make any sense. So that said, we acknowledge our biases. I've quit a lot of things in life and enjoyed it and benefited from it. So anyway, we did this podcast about quitting, and then Levitt turned it into an experiment that you should talk about.
Yeah, I mean, so this was the first time I think I ever began to appreciate the podcast, because we did this podcast. And then
to all you podcast listeners out there.
Then hundreds of people wrote us and said, I was so inspired by your podcast that I quit my job. I divorced my wife. You know, I did this. I dropped out of school. And I thought, wow, we actually, this is interesting, because in social science, we never, ever get to ask questions. I mean, we just don't know. Like, should people quit? I mean, it's a really important, should I quit my job? I mean, how would you even answer that? As an academic, you could maybe survey people, but what you really want is you want to find people who are teetering right on the edge, and they just can't decide, and you want to find a way to shove randomly half of them over the edge and like hold the others back. And I realized after the podcast that's exactly what we could do. So we started a webpage. It's called freakonomicsexperiments.com. And we told people who had a problem, come to our website and we'll help you make up your mind. And so we started with a survey where we asked people, and we tried to help them think differently about their problem so that maybe they could figure it out. But if at the end they told us they still weren't sure, we said, well, we'll really solve your problem. And we said, heads, you leave your wife, tails, you stay with her. And 40,000 people came to our webpage to do it. And amazingly, the people who came up heads, 60% of them followed the advice and did what heads was. And when it came up tails, 60% did what tails did. So there was a 20% of the people, 20% of those 40,000, actually, you know, changed what they were going to do based on our coin toss.
And people came up with big life decisions. I mean, this was divorce.
Yeah.
But did they also come up with more esoteric?
Oh,
just
get a tattoo or go on a diet. So it turned out of all the things that if you're not sure what to do, the data speak more clearly on, it is that if you're not sure if you should go on a diet or not, the data say you should go on a diet. That the happiest people three or six months later, are the people who tried to go on a diet. Much happier than the ones who did.
And the one activity that we heard from most after the podcast, that that probably 70% of the emails that people told us they quit something, it was running. So, plainly, everybody who's still running, give it up, because, you know.
And what's the progress of that experiment? That was a big investment. Are you still collecting?
No, so we printed it. So we still have the website. We know how important it is for people to have a coin out there to be able to flip when they have trouble. but we follow people for 6 months, and so we have about 2 months left or 1 month left of follow-up, and then we have some preliminary results that seem. I mean, certainly, I would say that the way I would categorize the results is that it's pretty clear that the people who quit are no worse off on most things than people who don't quit. And it actually looks, in many cases, like they're happier, that the people who quit were happier. And all the theory, you know, theory just so clearly points to that it's really a funny thing, which I hadn't thought of before, but I think is really true. Is the reason that it is so hard to quit is that every day you face a choice. Should I quit today or should I stick with it for one more day and quit tomorrow? And usually the quitting comes with pain. Right, that there's you have to tell your boss you're quitting. You have to, tell your wife that you're leaving or whatever, and that's very painful. And so you always say, "Well, God, I'd really like to quit, but I'm just going to wait one more day." And because there's always the same, the next day you're in the same quandary. You still have the should I quit today or tomorrow? And actually, the coin toss is interesting, as many people told us that the coin toss actually gave a sort of finality, and that it was really the coin was in the air, and it was something about the fact that you actually had to decide now. Freed them up to actually know while the coin was in the air that, they should or they shouldn't do it.
Did either of you guys use it?
I tried it to make sure it worked.
tried to make sure the flipper flipped?
And I did quit running, actually. But I would have done that without the podcast.
We're going to take some audience questions.
Great.
So
fantastic.
The first one from Linda Murray. You're so good at explaining the gaps between what we worry about and reality. What are we worried about that we shouldn't be, and what should we worry about that we're ignoring?
It's like a good one for
me.
You.
You're nodding at me. So what do we worry about that we shouldn't be is almost everything. I hate to say it. I mean, that's not a real answer, but I am constantly astonished at how so many people are convinced that the world is getting so much worse on so many dimensions. And then if you look at the actual dimensions that they're talking about, the world is getting better on those dimensions. Life expectancy, crime, and a lot of these, let's talk about U.S., So like in New York City, we're at record lows for deaths by fire, for instance, okay? Just take one thing like that. This is something that years ago used to be a major, major, major problem. My daughter now is in sixth grade history, learning the history of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. And if you think about, it's not just the gains to human life and so on, it's how rapidly we assimilate those gains and then quickly move on and expect more. And I think that is the part of the human condition that I'm most interested in, which is what are the diminishing returns on happiness? What does it take to make us satisfied and happy? So I think this is, I'm not saying that we should all be happy. I'm puzzled that we are not more satisfied than we are living in such relative prosperity relative to anywhere in history. So that to me is a real puzzle that is more of an answer to the question of what I want to be working on.
I have a quick answer to that too. I think one of the things for sure we should worry a lot less about is terrorism. I think that the amount of effort that goes into worrying what taking off our shoes in the airport and stuff like that, I mean, it's a lot of nonsense, I think. But I think, something I think we should worry more about, but I might be wrong, is pandemic. I think that we have a great faith in the health system and the knowledge of doctors and medicine. But I think when it comes to things like really bad flus, like the 1918 flu, if one of those came, it would just ravage the world in a way that people can't even comprehend, because I think the entire health system would shut down in a way that people, I mean, it just, you know, with
how much of this is a hunch, or do you have actual data to see?
So it's an informed hunch based on, in particular, a guy, Craig Fied, who a really knowledgeable guy who was involved with trying to develop ER. So one of the things we learned is that ERs recirculate air. So if there's something really, you know, really bad, you know, spores or whatever floating around in the air, it's like you're going to have to evacuate the ER. I mean, so it's like the craziest thing around.
In hospitals, you know, there's no ROI on a zero circulation room. So if you're a hospital board, say we should build all these new zero air circulation rooms because it will help us in the rare event of a pandemic. No one wants to do that.
There is nothing as terrifying as hearing you guys talk about disease while you're talking at me. Like, it is horrifying. Where is Linda, by the way? Because we have T-shirts for the first four people. All right, I cannot throw that far. another question. In the book, you mentioned that intelligent people are often the most biased, that they take the most extreme views and oftentimes are the hardest to change. And the question is, should we be governed by less intelligent people?
I think, could we
that
be governed?
That one's from Bob.
Could we be governed by less intelligent people?
I think there's actually there's a serious question here.
I mean, Obama is quite intelligent. Bill Clinton was really intelligent. I mean,
you skipped somebody in the middle there.
I've heard that he's not so bad either from people who are close to him in a very common sense kind of way. But this is your question, Dublin. You take it.
Oh, no, I mean, if I had a, should we be governed by less intelligent, if you want to be governed by less intelligent people, elect me. But I think, no, I don't think that's the solution. I think you want intelligence, but I think the challenge is to teach intelligent people to be less biased, and that's really hard. So this research that we wrote about in Think show is by a really interesting group called the Cultural Cognition Project. It basically shows that it's true. The more education a person has, the more likely they are to hold an extreme view on one end or the other of a topic like climate change, nuclear power, and so on. Which is puzzling. You would think that informed, educated people become the moderates. But it turns out that really smart people who are numerate and scientifically literate, for instance, on topics like this, tend to be smart enough to have a very strong view and make it even stronger by seeking out reading and evidence that confirms their bias, as opposed to seeking out the opposite. I think that is... it's not unaddressable, but it's a hard problem. But in fact, I think it's really addressable. I think, you know, if you listen to, you know, the far left radio station every day, listen to the opposite for a couple days a week. If you
know,
if everybody you know thinks a certain way, reads a certain set of books, has a certain set of ideas, it's possible mm-hmm. that you're all 100% right all the time, but it's not very likely. And so to cross-pollinate, I think, is at least a hedge against having a bias so strong that it will obliterate your ability to see another angle.
But you're saying there's a chance that we're right. That's all I want to hear. So, Bob, come get your T-shirt down front. I think this question's fascinating. From Lynn Foden, isn't data actually very subjective as you pick and choose the data you use? So... how do we know that something is, you know, essentially impartial? How can we rely on the numbers when there is inherent bias?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the nice thing about data, most data, are that they're publicly available, and critics can look at the data and see if they come to different conclusions. I mean, I'm very much in favor of simple data analysis. At least always start with just a portrayal of the data so that anyone can see the raw data that's in there. And then you can get into fancier things and put more of your personality into it.
But data has personality? You can put personality in data?
Oh, absolutely. So in economics, in economics, for instance, there's a war raging between what are called the structural and the reduced form people. I'm not going into the details of it, but it's religious. It's a religious thing, and you really almost have to declare your faith as a graduate student. And if you declare yourself in one camp, then the members of the other camp will do everything they can to make sure you never get employed and stuff like that. And so absolutely. And
sounds like a fun bunch.
Yeah, don't. So my advice is don't get a PhD in economics. The pain is high and the rewards are generally low. So I think, I mean, but just going to, I mean, mm-hmm. what the question said about data is, of course, true about everything, right? Mm-hmm. And probably less true of data than storytelling, a pure storytelling or anecdote or polling or whatever you would do. So, yeah, I mean, I think many things that you read are wrong, and you know we talk all the time about correlation versus causality, okay? And what makes data so hard is that the only thing you actually see in the data directly is correlation, right? You just know, do two things tend to go together? Causality comes from somewhere deeper. Causality is something which, absent a randomized experiment, you have to intuit or trick the data into revealing. And all we really care about is causality, and that's the fundamental challenge of social science, is in a world where you see correlations, how can you know causality? And that's where the art and the fun and the joy of what we do comes in.
So Linda, come down and get your T-shirt. Keith Bailey asks, was there anything that you're afraid of to put in your books, or on the podcast for that matter? Do you still struggle with the moral compass that you mentioned, trying to put aside?
No, never did.
Never did.
Terminator over here seems all right.
We did. We did kind of get censored. One thing they censored.
What was that? Hang on.
What'd
about
you get
Paul Krugman? We made fun of Paul Krugman, and that kind of got censored.
Oh,
out.
Yeah. So we made.
We didn't do it ourselves,
notes.
But it disappeared from the book.
I took it out. It was because we made fun of him in a different spot in the book, and it just felt like piling on. I think because. Uh-huh. Yeah, so it wasn't really making. It was kind of admiring Paul Krugman. We were talking about in an insulting way, I guess. no, but it wasn't making fun of him. But it was we were making a point about rhetoric. So I used to teach this freshman comp course at Columbia years ago called Logic and Rhetoric, which isn't taught anymore, which is a shame because it's about making a good persuasive piece of writing, mm-hmm. and you have to have obviously. A lot of logic, and your rhetoric has to be good too. And it was in this chapter we're writing in the book called How to Persuade People Who Don't Want to Be Persuaded, which, as one could connote from our earlier conversation about bias, is really, really, really hard. And so we listed a series of rules that if you're really determined to try to persuade people who don't want to be persuaded, what you could try to do, and then some of the surefire things to not do. And one of the surefire things to not do is insult people in the course of your argument. The minute you start calling people names, it's just like the most basic thing, and yet a lot of smart people seem to forget it. But once you start personally insulting your opponent, there's no way he's going to come around to your side of the argument. It's just human, very few humans have a psyche that's strong enough or weak enough to do that. So we looked for examples of that, and we made the point that people who do that aren't really trying to persuade. They're trying to write their op-ed piece to kind of preach to their choir and state their ideology, which is one thing, and fine if that's what you want to do, but don't pretend you're trying to persuade. So in the course of making this argument, we went through, you know, Krugman is one of the most, what's a good word for me?
What's a non-insulting word?
No, a word for, he likes to insult the enemy. He likes to, he calls names. He literally just calls names a lot. So much so that I love reading his column just to see what he's going to come up with today. It's like, that guy, those Republicans are real gollabazoos. And you go, look what's gollabazoos. So anyway, so we decided to just go through some Krugman columns literally just to pick the words that were insults that would make a good list that would be fun to read. And I thought I'd have to go through like a couple years of columns. I went through 3 weeks of columns and I had a list and it looked like, it reminded me of when my daughter was in like second grade at school, they made this big word cloud on the board. These are the words we don't say at school. And that's what the Paul Krugman cloud looked like. So that's,
you've been at this now for the better part of a decade. 11 years has it been since you first met. Mm-hmm. What are you actually hoping the legacy of Freakonomics is going to be?
That's a nice question. Hard.
I don't know.
Flip time?
I'll give a super narrow and self-interested answer as the writer half. I hope when my kids have kids that there are still books around. And I don't really care if mine are around, but I hope there are books around, because that's why I love the idea. I love doing this. I love doing a podcast. But to me, a book is a thing that has no equal. It's funny what you people... It's funny what you people clap at. Books and terrorism, apparently. Yeah. So anyway, my hope is that there are books and that maybe, you know, this will be one of them.
Do you have a hope for what the legacy will be of Freaking
No,
Games?
I mean, we we started with the thought that nobody would ever read the book. And that freed us up to write the first book in a way that was unusual, to write a different kind of book. And I think... we wanted to have fun ourselves, and if other people have fun too, that's great. I think that's really, I mean, we're really spoiled. We're incredibly spoiled in that we hardly have to do anything we don't want to do, and except for book tours, which, but other than that, we pretty much get to call the shots, and so it's just, we try to have fun when we do it.
Well, you've been generous with your time.
Let the
here.
Radio record show that our friend is eating bacon while reading that.
I flipped a coin in my mind. It's time for our last question. And it's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. Stephen and Stephen, mm-hmm. You decide who goes first. What are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
You want to go first? Or me?
You can go first. Yeah.
Mine is really simple and really, really unpopular. And I think that...
Really what? Improvident?
Unpopular.
Unpopular.
I think that people should pay for their health care, and if you want to get really expensive treatments, you should have to pay a big chunk of that, and I think we should treat health and life and death more like a regular good, and we spend 20%, coming up to 20% of GDP on health care, and we have to, it's unfortunate, but we have to make these horrible choices where we decide, you know, ultimately, either society or the individual has to make the choice of, are we going to, like, send our kids to college, or are we going to keep great-grandma alive for two more weeks? And the cost might be about the same for those two things. And right now, we shy away from those decisions, and we pretend like they're not, like life has infinite value and that we can't make these choices. But somebody's going to make them. Either people will or governments will. And I think that it's a really simple solution to healthcare. Is to give people catastrophic insurance, but to make them pay for what they use, and people will be much smarter about it, and hospitals will stop charging, you know, $7,000 for an MRI that the marginal cost of it is $75, and I think the world would be a better place.
And Dubner, yours. Dubner, your 60 seconds.
So I don't know how to do this, but what I want to do, which is a project I've been working on as a writer for a long time, is understand happiness better, what makes people happy, and really what makes people unhappy. So, I mean, to me, there are a lot of obvious triggers for what makes people unhappy, but once you drill deeper, they're not as obvious. So poverty would seem to be an obvious one, but there are many people in poverty who are extremely happy. My family grew up in what would technically be called poverty with... You know, I was the youngest of eight kids with a copy editor for a dad who died when I was a kid. And we were like this poor rural farm family that if you looked at us on paper, you would say, oh, my gosh, those poor people. And we were perfectly happy. I know many, many rich people who are miserable. What we think we know about happiness, what we actually know about happiness could really fit on the pin of a needle, the head of a needle. And I think it's a shame that we've done so much as a civilization to produce so many wonderful things, from food to technology, on and on and on, and that we are in this state where we don't appreciate them very well. I'm not saying we're wrong to not appreciate them, but I'm puzzled by it, and I would love to figure something out because I don't like so many people running around being so angry all the time. I think life is pretty amazing, and it would be better if everybody could lift everybody else up, even just 1%. I would love that.
And on that incredible, uplifting note, let's give a big round of applause to the head freaks, Stephen Bubner and Stephen Levitt.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I got the gap. How about you do the honors?
How many times?
Three.